Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. Maybe a word of explanation there. There are only four of us at the bench this morning, but Justice Salter is healing up from an ankle injury and also has a virus, so he is appearing by telephone and will participate fully not only in the oral argument, but also in our conferencing of the case after the argument. Justice Salter, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Good morning.
Okay, very good. Good to hear your voice. The first case for oral argument this morning is the Pickerel Lake Outlet Association and many other appellants versus Dade County, South Dakota, the appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Jack Hebe, an attorney from Aberdeen. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Stacey Hagee, an assistant attorney general from Pierre, and Mr. Danny Smines, the Dade County State's attorney from Webster. I understand, Ms. Hagee, you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct,
yeah. All right, and I believe that covers it. So, Mr. Hebe, you have 20 minutes, sir. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I'd like to start out the argument by pointing out something that is readily apparent from the review of the record that I feel like the JV team in this case, this was Ron Parsons' case, and he got the appointment to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I agreed to take it over for him. I hope to do it justice, but those are big shoes to fill. I want to talk about the things that I believe are undisputed in the case, because I think that helps us get to the things that I guess really matter, in my opinion, with respect to this matter. This is a purely de novo review. We don't have an argument about that. I mean, everything that is up for decision here, I believe, is up for decision on a de novo standard.
There's no disputed facts, really, either, are there?
And I think I believe that to be true, Your Honor. I think both parties made that assertion. Ms. Hagee was successful and Mr. Parsons was not. But I think that is a fair statement, especially if the court analyzes the precedent in the way that I think it should be analyzed for purposes of looking at whether there is express preemption here. But the things that we know in this case that are relevant are that, number one, the land where these structures are located is trust land, and it is land that applies to the statute that's in question. Ms. Hagee asked me before the argument how I intended to refer the statute, if I was going to call it by the originating number or the successor number, and I said, I'm going to refer to it as the statute. And she said, that sounds like a good idea. There's only one of them, so when I'm talking about 25 U.S.C. 5108, I will be talking about the statute. And the statute in this case, I don't think there's a dispute that it does apply to the land in question here. There is no dispute that the plaintiffs in this case and the association are either non-tribal entities or non-tribal members. They are non-Indians. That is undisputed. And I think it's also undisputed that the issue relates to cabins, cottages, and other structures that are located on that trust land. The tax in question is an ad valorem tax. It's a tax that's being imposed by Dade County pursuant to the laws of South Dakota that allow them to tax structures of this nature that are attached to leased property. And it's also undisputed, I believe, that the BIA, as part of the Department of Interior, is the federal agency that administers the statute that we're talking about today.
Did they pay the taxes under protest, or did they just stop paying?
They paid the taxes. Your Honor.
A mix?
I know some of them paid the taxes under protest. I will not try to represent to the court that as of this day, each of my clients has paid their taxes under protest in all cases. I don't know that. I know that was the case, at least during the early parts of the case. And I think, you know, the fact that this case was, or the complaint was amended a couple of times. I think the decision was made by Mr. Parsons to seek the prospective declaratory relief because I think the concern was far more about getting this thing to a decision so that the court could determine whether this is a legal tax than necessarily the normal situation where we have the two-step process of you pay them, you sue, you appeal, and you run that dual track.
You know, just a matter of question. I'm familiar with the area somewhat, but these are actual physical buildings. This ain't like a mobile home or a fifth wheel they backed in there, right?
You and I are both familiar with them, Your Honor. And if you look at the settled record, pages 171 to 195 would include photographs, I believe, of the majority of these structures. And that, in fact, is true. I am not going to represent, Your Honor, that there are not, in some cases, mobile homes. But I think, you know, one man's castle is another man's sure. mobile home. And these are not fifth-wheel campers that are set there for a week or two.
Well, it is kind of important because my understanding is if you own a mobile home, you put a little tag on there like a car license. But these are actually, they're going like a real estate tax, and it's a fixed building.
Yes, these are structures, and this issue about whether they are fixtures, I really don't believe is an issue when you look at the Code of Federal Regulations and the definitions they have placed on what constitutes a permanent improvement. These are clearly, in my opinion, permanent improvements under the Code of Federal Regulations that we've cited in our brief. In fact, I think it's 25 CFR 162.017.
Have there been any cases that have construed those CFRs or talked about them in terms of those definitions?
Not the definitions, Your Honor. I have not come across a case where a court has said that deference should not be given to those definitions. I believe the BIA clearly has not only the authority, but the obligation to promulgate. I have not seen any court challenge the efficacy or the legality of those definitions that are found in the CFR. What has been challenged, as the court is well aware from looking at the cases, I'm sure, by some courts, is the additional step that the BIA took in the Federal Register of declaring that this statute preempts any attempt to tax a structure regardless of who owns the structure. That has been challenged. But I don't believe it could be effectively challenged because clearly the BIA has the authority and is charged with the responsibility for saying, how do we implement this? And that I don't believe has been challenged. And nor do I believe it's an issue in this case.
And all your clients go to old agency and annually pay some kind of a tax to the tribe? Is that the way it works?
Yes. There's an ad valorem tax they pay to the tribe. That started, I believe, in 2014, according to the record. The tribe clearly has that authority to enforce that tax. That's something else that we find from the CFR and the recent pronouncements of the BIA. The same pronouncement in the CFR where the BIA says it doesn't matter who owns the property, it cannot be subject to an ad valorem tax on the structures. They say, but the tribe can. And that's what the tribe has started doing since 2014, Your Honor.
Mr. Heap, can I take you back to one of the earlier comments you had about things that you thought were undisputed in the case? And that you may be absolutely right. And I approached the case with one of the kind of the premise that you expressed early on, which was that the land that we're talking about here is, in fact, land that was acquired under the IRA. And I went with that until I read Judge Flemmer's January 2018 decision, and he makes an effort to distinguish Mescalero there. And in so doing, he says, the record in this case does not indicate anything was acquired pursuant to the IRA. And then I noticed various references in the succession of complaints and in the statement of undisputed material facts that sort of said some of the land that is at issue here was acquired under the IRA. And if the argument is express preemption under the IRA, so you took it pursuant to the IRA and you can't tax it, and that's express preemption, isn't it really important that we really understand the status of this land? Because there can be other kinds of trust land other than land that was fee to trust land.
I think that the answer to your question is yes, it is very important. My belief is that the entire 30-plus acre parcel in question that was entered into via a lease through the BIA fits within the definition of trust land under the federal regulation that we have provided to the court. But
the IRA says, it has to be land acquired pursuant to the IRA. So that's fee to trust. It was in fee. They took it into trust. There can be all kinds of trust land. It could be allotted trust. There could be unallotted trust, tribal trust of various, origins. But don't we have to know? And maybe if it's not a dispute, I'll ask Ms. Hagee. If it's not a dispute, maybe it's nothing we need to worry about. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Heap. I apologize.
That's okay. I do agree that it's important, but I also believe that under the definitions found in the Code of Federal Regulations and the case law, I don't think there's any dispute but that this trust land qualifies. I would like to get to the law on this, and I kind of want to talk about how we got here. And I think it's fairly apparent when you look at the cases, because once we understand those things that we know, I really don't think this case is that difficult to disentangle. The thing that started all of it was Rickard out of Roberts County, which is always interesting when you practice in South Dakota and you see a U.S. Supreme Court case that comes right out of your neck of the woods. And in that case, back in 1909 or 1903, Roberts County was attempting to tax improvements on trust land, but those improvements were owned by tribal members. And they said, well, we're not taxing the land, we're taxing the improvements. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That attempts to tax improvements that are owned by tribal members that are situated on trust land, and that runs afoul of our longstanding policy. It's no different than taxing the land. And moving forward from there, and what I thought was important before we get to the IRA, is the West case, which was a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1948, which cites to Rickard. And the reason I thought it was important is that in the West case, they don't focus on what they focus on are the beneficent objects relative to the dependent class of individuals. So in other words, what they're saying is, look, to tax the improvements would be to tax a means employed by the government to accomplish the beneficent objects. They're not looking at the color of the person's skin who owns the object or the structure. What they're saying is, if you tax that thing, you are getting in the way of Congress's ability to manage this property effectively and to do their job. I believe that's the essence of the West holding. In between there, the IRA gets passed in 1934, which really, I believe, in a lot of ways, codifies Rickard. I mean, I think in some ways that part of the IRA that we're talking about here simply recognizes what the Supreme Court was saying in Rickard and gives it basically a congressional stamp of approval. That's why I believe when you look at that history, when you look at the language of that statute, and you look at how the U.S. Supreme Court then interprets this in Mescalero, there is express preemption here. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. I don't believe Mescalero turns at all on whether the ski resort that was located on the reservation is owned by the tribe or not. Those factors were being thrown out there. They were being argued to the court, but the court did not seem to care. That was not part of the court's analysis. It would be like this court looking at whether to suppress evidence in a DUI conviction and having somebody say, yeah, well, they suppressed that in Hand County, but this one happened in Minor County. I don't believe the facts that are being argued as being distinguishing factors in Mescalero are really relevant. What I think is relevant for Mescalero is the court's, you know, pronouncement that every reason that can be urged to show that the land was not subject to taxation applies to the assessment and taxation of the permanent improvements. They're saying the permanent improvements are so inherently tied to the land that you can't disentangle them, and if you try to tax those, you might as well be taxing the land. And we think that is expressly prohibited by Congress in the language of the IRA.
But isn't the point of the IRA to protect Indian interests? How does the imposition of a tax on non-Indian structures in Day County affect the tribe's interest? There's no showing that it's been chilling in the record.
That's accurate, Your Honor. There is no showing. And I don't think that that same issue came up in some of the federal cases that we have cited, where the courts have said, well, you've made no showing that it had a negative economic impact on the tribe. What the courts have said that have followed the Mescalero decision, particularly the Ninth and the 11th circuits, especially the Ninth Circuit, is we don't need to go there. If we read Mescalero the way I believe we have to read it, the Supreme Court has said it's expressly preempted. We don't get into that balancing analysis to try to determine whether, you know, there's been a showing in the record of a negative economic impact, similar to what you saw in the oil and gas lease cases, which, you know, were distinguished for a number of reasons, but that was one of the reasons they were distinguished, was the whole economic benefit analysis, saying it's the burden is on the party seeking to invalidate the tax to show that there is a negative economic impact. I think what Mescalero says, and I believe what the two federal courts that have followed it say, are that our job is to interpret the intent of Congress. And if we interpret the intent of Congress to be that a state or local government is not allowed to impose a tax that will affect either the management, the control, or essentially the job of the federal government to manage this property, then we deem it to be preempted. In fact, that's exactly what the court said in the Ninth Circuit case, the Chehalis case, where that those types of arguments were being made about, you know, we should use the Bracker balancing. You know, the Bracker test is the one that I believe Judge Flemmer was sort of referring to in the decision about how you look at all these factors. And what the Ninth Circuit said is that the Bracker balancing test is irrelevant to a question that involves property taxes implicated by this statute. You don't go there. Not if you determine that Congress intended to preempt it.
How, in this case, to use your terms, does the tribe manage, or the federal government manage, control, or operate this particular property?
They have to approve the leases. So if you see in the record...
And I think, sorry to interrupt, but I think that was one of the points made in the opposing brief, is that these subleases, there's nothing in the record that shows that these subleases were approved by the BIA pursuant to the federal reg.
That is an accurate statement.
It's inaccurate?
That is an accurate statement. I apologize. These subleases, I don't believe there's anything in the record to show those are approved. I do believe in the CFR that I cited for the court, and I apologize, I don't rattle those off very well, there is a definition of a lease, and within that definition it talks about subleases. But I believe that's also why the association itself is named as a party to this case, because they are the entity that is involved in the lease that was approved or is made with the BIA.
So the lease with the association was approved by the BIA, but not the individual subleases to these property owners?
I would say it was not those were not expressly approved, but I believe they are allowed pursuant to regulation. But I do believe they manage it. I mean, in fact, you couldn't enter into, they couldn't put these structures out there without the BIA's approval.
And then, of course, the lease then refers to a requirement that the structures be removed on the termination of the lease.
Correct.
Which seems to be sort of at odds with the permanent structure language there that you quote. So how do you reconcile that?
The way I reconcile it is by going to the definition found in the CFR. I had the exact same issue, but then I thought about it. And I thought about the ski lodge that was built in Mescalero. The term permanent has such a broad meaning. At some point, that ski lodge is going to go away. The ski lifts are going to go away. Every building has a life. And as Chief Justice Gilbertson pointed out, if you look at the photographs that are in the record in this case, these cabins don't look any different than, you know, a lot of other lake cabins that are on lakes. So I think the term permanent, if you're going to take it to the extreme and say, well, these certainly can't be permanent because they could be moved. My house could be moved. My house could be destroyed. It could be knocked down. But Brown County certainly treats it as a permanent improvement to my real estate when they tax me. And I think that's where you look to the definition provided by the BAA, because I believe they have the authority to provide that definition, and they have. They have indicated that structures of this nature are to be considered permanent improvements. That's how they do it definitionally in the code. I see that I'm out of time, so I will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Hebe. Ms. Hagee, you have 20 minutes.
Please, the court, counsel. The plaintiffs in this case are trying to take advantage of a congressional protection accorded to only tribes and individual Indians. And their overly stretched application of the statute here is precisely why they don't have standing to bring this claim under the statute at issue.
Well, if Dade County has the authority to tax, they have to have the authority to enforce the tax. Say one of these plaintiffs says, Dade County, I'm not paying. What's Dade County going to do about it? They can't, I don't know how they get on the trust land to seize the building, sell it. So if they don't have authority to enforce the tax, how do they have authority to tax it itself?
I think there's several instances just coming to mind where there may be jurisdiction to tax, but no authority to enforce it on tribal reservations or on Indian reservations. I think it's it occurs where you may have the authority to impose a use tax, but you cannot necessarily go in and ask the tribe to collect that use tax for you, situations like that. For purposes of whether Dade County can enforce this tax, I would think the normal tax deed, tax lien statutes would apply in this instance. I don't know of anything that would stop Dade County from trying to effectuate that.
Well, then say that they take the property off, sell it or something. That means that the building is no longer on the trust land, and therefore the original owner is not going to pay the taxes to the tribe. Isn't that an economic detriment to the tribe? They just lost the ability to collect that revenue.
There's nothing in the record saying that that would affect any of the tribe's economic development. And further, I think in that situation, you're looking at this is non-Indians property. I don't believe the statute here provides a tribe exclusive right to seize a non-Indians property in order to get any tax revenue it may desire. That line of thinking would also prevent and just thinking about it if there was a construction lien on it. Is that not allowed just because it would possibly affect a tribe's interest in obtaining its tax revenue? Now, the plaintiffs here are non-tribal members. There's no tribal interest. There's no federal governmental interest in these properties. They're entirely owned. There's no reversionary interest. That sets us far apart from Mescalero and from the Chehalis case of the Ninth Circuit, where there was full tribal ownership of the structures being taxed. And in Chehalis, there was a 51% tribal interest in the structures. And not only that, but the tribe was going to get the entire ownership of the property after 25 years. That was stated in the facts, and it was certainly a fact that you can't dismiss, especially when you look at the repeated assertions that the tax exemption shouldn't turn on how the tribe is conducting its business. In that instance, they're looking at how is the tribe conducting their business. Are they is it a tribal corporation, or are they owning a portion of it? And there's still that tribal interest involved. Here, there is no tribal interest.
Well, Ms. Hagee, if I could interrupt you. So the IRA was enacted to, among other things, stabilize a deteriorating post-allotment Indian land base. And it followed a number of moratoriums in the 20s and was ultimately, you know, enacted in 1934. And part of that purpose was also to allow federally recognized Indian tribes the beneficial use of the land that they would take from fee status and put into trust status. So when it comes to double taxation, I know there's, you know, Cotton Petroleum says what it says, and the court, the Supreme Court of the United States has recognized that that may not necessarily be problematic or fatal. But isn't that kind of inconsistent with the purpose of the IRA, which is to allow tribes the beneficial use of land that comes from a fee status back into trust status?
Yes, Your Honor, but here again, there's no assertion by the tribe that this conflicts with their right to economically develop the property. In fact, the record shows that there has been no development on these parcels by the tribe. The tribe only recently started imposing its tax in 2014, and that's really why this case is being brought, is because of that double taxation. But now the plaintiffs are coming back and challenging the county's ability to tax that. Regardless, I still think you have to fit within the plain language of the statute. These tax exemptions are not granted by implication, and that really means that Congress has to mean to exempt the tax. They have to say it in plain words. These tax exemptions are an act of legislative grace.
What if one of these plaintiffs was an enrolled member of the tribe? Did you tax his cabin?
In that, to answer that question, Your Honor, I have to go back and point out that there is no evidence in the record that these structures the land underneath were acquired pursuant to the IRA.
Everybody knows all that trust land is the residue of the original reservation. And when it was disestablished in 1892, the balance of the trust land stayed in trust, except for a few parcels up there that were purchased for economic development elsewhere in the former reservation. I haven't read anybody challenging that. It's always been trust lands.
Well, I have a question on that, actually. Ms. Hagee, maybe you can tell me. The IRA trust land is its own deal. That's fee to trust. It's formerly fee, now came into trust under 465 or 5108. So what you just said is what I'd asked Mr. Heeb and what I had seen a couple of references to, and it seems really important to me that if you want to benefit from what may be this, you know, source of a tax exemption within the text of 5108, you need to show that the land was in fact taken into trust from a fee status. So do you agree that it was, or is it just unclear? Do you think it matters? What's your thought?
Plaintiffs, in their complaint, they did not allege that this land was taken into trust pursuant to the IRA. There's no evidence of this in the record. The state, the county and the state pointed this out in page 18 of our brief. And as you indicated, the circuit court said that there's no evidence that anything was acquired pursuant to the IRA. And so that takes us out of the realm of the statute here.
Well, wouldn't that mean you win then?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, in regards to the statute, now plaintiffs here also want to talk about the regulations that are being implemented over the leasing of the property. But again, there's no lease agreement here between the plaintiffs and their structures and the BIA. These subleases are required to be approved under the leasing regulations, but no subleases have been through that approval process that's in the record. And further, this is not a tax on the actual lease process. In Seminole Tribe versus Strandberg, now that was a tax on the lease. They were seeking to tax the rental payments made between the tribe and the individuals. Here, that's not what the county and the state is doing. We're taxing the structures that are entirely owned by the non-tribal members.
I think Mr. Heave mentioned, when I asked the similar question, that there is language in the lease with the association that may refer to the subleases. The lease that was approved with the association. Do you have the same view of that?
Yes, to my knowledge, the lease was approved by the BIA, between the BIA and the outlet association.
But then did that lease mention the ability to sublease, or how were the subleases referenced in that lease agreement?
I have it here right off the top of my head. I don't know for sure, but I'm fairly certain that the subleases still have to be approved by the BIA. And I'm fairly certain that the lease indicates that as much, but I can't say for certain, Your Honor.
And is there language in the CFRs that indicate that the subleases have to be approved by the BIA?
I believe so, Your Honor, but then again, I'm not entirely 100% confident in that. Now, one thing you'll notice in all of these cases relied upon by plaintiffs, and all of the ones that we're talking about here today, is the tribe was a party to the case. The tribe was bringing the lawsuit. The tribe was challenging the tax. Presumably, they're the ones that had the interest in the property. Here, there's no tribe that is in this litigation. And in that instance, the Indian law canon of construction, which may have been in play in those other cases, doesn't apply here where there's no Indian or tribe involved.
Can you turn to the question of preemption and the applicability of White Mountain Apache versus Bracker? Does the Bracker balancing test apply?
In that regard, I would agree with Mr. Heeb that we don't have to look at the Bracker balancing test. As discussed in the Ninth Circuit case in Chehalis, they really indicated that the Bracker balancing hasn't been extended to cases of property ownership. It's only been looked at least by the United States Supreme Court in regarding the taxation of non-Indians or non-tribal member activities on the reservation. Now, other lower courts have seemingly applied the Bracker balancing in various situations, but that's, again, where I would agree with counsel that, no, we don't have to look at the Bracker balancing in this case.
And so what would you apply, field preemption or regular preemption analysis?
Just the regular preemption analysis, whether it's express preemption, which plaintiffs have relied upon the statute here, or implied preemption, which I believe plaintiffs briefly addressed at the very end of their brief regarding whether it occupies the field. And importantly, in implied preemption, the plaintiffs cannot assert the rights of a third party in seeking that implied preemption. They can't say that this is affecting the tribe's right to self-government or the tribe's interests. The tribe is not, again, not a party to this case. Now, looking at whether the tax is preempted or not, I think it's important to go back to the general rule that the state initially has had the authority to tax us even prior to the IRA in 1934. Our court has indicated in Lebo versus Griffith case that it upheld the state tax on non-Indians on reservation personal property, which at that time did include permanent improvements. the United States Supreme Court has also upheld the ability to of a state or county to tax non-Indians' property on the reservation prior to the Indian Reorganization Act, and I believe one of those cases was even after in 1937. Now, that's the general rule, and in order to take away that general rule, Congress really had to be clear in what they were doing, that they were changing this rule. Here, through the statute at play, that is not that clear indication that they change, that they plan to switch course. And that's kind of in line with the strong presumption against federal preemption here. Here, this was a power that was, it was, the state had this authority, and so there's a strong presumption to, a strong presumption in against preemption. Sorry about that. That's a mouthful.
We got it.
So they really had a high hurdle to go over if they wanted to change this general rule. Article 22 of the South Dakota Constitution does not change that general rule. In that clause, it indicates that no taxes shall be imposed by the state on lands or property therein belonging to, or which may hereafter be purchased by the United States. Now, looking at that, that only applies to the property purchased by the United States. And I think it's really unique to see that they're really talking about lands and property separate from. They're treating those two things differently, just as South Dakota does. We tax lands separately than the structures on the land. If you think of your Director of Equalization assessment of real property, there's the assessed value for the land and the assessed value for the structures. This isn't uncommon to break those two apart, to separate the structures on the land from the land. That's what
South Dakota. But that taxation concept or property law concept for preemption analysis would have to focus on probably, you know, the federal acts that are at issue. I mean, could you analyze a federal preemption case by grafting into it state law concepts?
I think you can, Your Honor, and I think that's actually precisely what the Eighth Circuit did in the 1993 case of Black Hills Institute of Geological Research versus South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. In that case, they looked at the definition of land for the statute preceding the one at play here, Section 464 or 5107 under the reorganization. In that case, to define land, since the IRA didn't define the term land, they looked to state law and said that the land is the solid material of the earth, whatever may be the ingredients of which it is composed, whether soil, rock, or other substance. Now, they pulled that definition from SDCL 43-1-2. And so since the statute is, I mean, immediately following that, I think those same definitions should apply, and we should be looking at state law and how these particular instances are set out. Here, the taxation does not go against the purpose of the IRA to halt Indians' loss of property. Now, the IRA granted that authority for federal government to purchase the land for providing it to Indians, and this tax exemption was important in that respect to prevent states from taxing the property, and if that tax wasn't paid to going on and taking the Indians' property. Here, that is not the situation. This is not any Indians' property. This is non-tribal property, and it doesn't frustrate that purpose of Indians' loss of property. In regard to the standing argument, the state and the county say that plaintiffs can't assert, they can't bring this claim under the statute at issue here. It's clear that the statute doesn't go against halting the loss of their property. It's really aimed at halting the loss of Indian property and intended to protect those Native American interests. The plaintiffs don't have any standing to invoke that. plaintiffs in their brief, they say that, well, that's more of a federal prudential standing requirement, more, and we're here in state court. But this court has recognized that the zone of interest consideration is certainly included in the question of standing. It just did so recently in the Flaws case of 2016 SD 60, where it said that that was one of the considerations for standing. So it's not just in federal courts. It's also been pointed out in state courts.
But don't
as well.
We have statutory recognition in South Dakota of this standing of a taxpayer to challenge a tax? I mean, 1027-1 is one of the statutes. I can't remember the other one where you have two methods of, as a taxpayer, to challenge the legality or the amount of the tax.
And I think, Your Honor, here, this case was not brought under 1027-1. And in looking at it, they can certainly challenge the tax on other grounds, but whether they can try to invoke the tribe's right, the tribe's interest through this statute, that's not what's covered here, and that's why the plaintiffs don't have standing in this case.
Weren't our cases, though, applying that test more in the nature of third parties trying to assert a right who weren't directly impacted?
And when you
and
say
also addressing constitutional issues as well,
namely Flaws and Goodlands.
Yeah, it wasn't, Your Honor. It wasn't brought up particularly in the context that we're talking about here. But this certainly was a consideration laid out by the court. It's one that we think really applies here when plaintiffs are trying to invoke the statute not intended for them. Now, ultimately, the county is imposing a tax on the plaintiffs' cabins and garages. It's not a tax on the land, and it's not a tax on the lease agreement. Plaintiffs are owning those structures in their entirety, and they have pointed to no case where a court has invoked this statute to exempt from taxation these structures. They have not overcome their strong presumption against federal preemption, especially when considering the IRA and its requirements that it be acquired into trust.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Eve, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And I don't know if this answers the question or not, Justice Salter, but when I was referring to the Code of Federal Regulations, I was looking at 25 CFR 162.003, which provides definitions. And in that section, they provide definitions for what constitutes trust or restricted status for purposes of parcels of land that would qualify for the protection under the statute. And I don't believe that, I did not believe coming in here, I guess, that there was any dispute of fact regarding whether this particular land fits within that definition or within the protection of the IRA. I would suggest that if that is something that the court believes has not been shown by the record, that would be a basis for remand, and we could establish that at the trial court level before it would be decided on the merits. But that is the section I was referring to when I said that I believe the regs address that.
No, thank you for following that up. And I thought about that as well, but I think this regulation was promulgated pursuant to the IRA. So, you know, I don't know that it could, you know, as a regulatory effort, go beyond the text of the statute. So in any event, but I understand your answer. Thank you for pointing me into that.
You're welcome.
It seems to me that you have a general history in the Dakota versus District County Court case of how the whole process unfolded between Congress terminating the reservation and then 15% of the parcels remaining in trust within those boundaries. And
I don't pretend to be an expert on the IRA. I've done as much as I can to understand this history, starting with my time in Professor Pommersheim's class, and I really hope he's not listening to this. And if he is, I hope he realizes I did listen to some things and understand some of it. But I don't think that the protections built into the IRA as they relate to preemption necessarily are confined to those parts of the IRA that facilitated the repurchase of land by the federal government for the benefit of tribes. Now, I may be going on a limb when I say that, but that's not how I read the protections set forth in that law with respect to preemption. So that would be my answer. And as I indicated previously, if the court thinks that that is a something that hasn't been proven in the record, then maybe we do have a dispute of fact, and maybe that needs to be fleshed out, because I'm certain that could be done relatively easily. This idea that's being espoused, that this doesn't affect the tribe, I understand it on one level, but I don't understand it on another, and I think it's where the courts in Mescalero and the Ninth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit have all come down with respect to express preemption. Unless you live in California or someplace where you believe that you can't tax something too much, I think it's a given that the more taxes you impose on something, the less valuable it will become to the person who may seek to otherwise avail themselves of it. And I believe that has been the root or the basis of every one of these decisions when the court has said, look, within that bundle of rights that we all learn about in property class that comes with the ownership of property, within that bundle, one of the big sticks in that bundle is the ability to lease. The ability, if you choose to give that those rights or some of those rights to a third party who will pay you value for that. And what the courts have said is if you take away that by taxing it or by controlling it or by affecting it in any way, you are doing the same thing as you would be doing if you put a tax directly on the land. And that's where I disagree with the state when they say that it's important to look at the nature of the entities that have owned these various ventures on the reservations or within Indian country when they have said preemption expressly applies here, because those courts haven't looked at that. And they've flatly said that that's not relevant, because what we're looking at here is the interference with the economic development that this statute is designed to foster and protect.
Didn't they look at it in Chehalis, the Ninth Circuit case, where the tribe had a 51% interest?
Yeah, they did. And then
they looked at who bore the incidence of the tax.
And I think that's fair. When I say they didn't look at it, they did look at it. It was argued extensively in Chehalis, in all of the cases. But what they said in Chehalis is that it's not really relevant at the end of the day. It doesn't matter who owns the corporation that owns the property that's being taxed. Because the argument there, of course, that was being made is this is not the tribe. This is not a tribal member. This is a domestic corporation. The tribe may be a shareholder of it, but that in the eyes of the law is irrelevant, because this is just a domestic corporation. Take it for what it is, court, and apply the law accordingly. And the court took them up on that. The court said, okay, yeah, we'll bite. You know, the tribe, go ahead.
When we're talking about a tax on property itself, first, as a starting premise, do you agree that the tribe does not, or the federal government for that matter, does not own the structures or the buildings on the property?
Correct.
Is that's built, that's what it says in the lease?
Yes.
So the counter, your opponent is arguing there's a difference between, so we have tax on land versus tax on structures.
Yes.
And so here, county is not dealing with the tax on the land, which is clearly owned by the tribe, and we're not taxing the profits or the lease, the actual lease agreement, the proceeds that they receive from the lease.
Yes.
So why is that not a valid distinction?
Because of Mescalero, because of Strandberg, and because of Chehalis, and because of the way the BIA has sought to define the term property within the federal regulations. There is not a single case that has come down since Mescalero, since the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Mescalero in the 70s, where a federal court interpreting this statute has said you can avoid the prohibition by putting an ad valorem tax on the structures that are on the real property or the land. There have only been two cases that have addressed the issue, and those have both said that is expressly preempted per Mescalero.
And the two cases you're referring to are the other circuit cases?
The Ninth Circuit case and the 11th Circuit case. The Ninth Circuit case is the Confederate Tribes of Chehalis in 2013, and the 2015 case from the 11th Circuit is the Seminole Tribe of Florida versus Strandberg.
And in that case, the tax fell on a non-Indian utility company.
Correct. Yes.
So who did the incidence of the tax fall upon? A non-Indian company. And they upheld it in the 11th Circuit case. Strandberg.
The utility tax.
Yeah.
But they did not uphold the tax that was being levied against the non-Indian vendors that were in the casino, that they were trying to put a use tax on for the ability to operate their vending activities in the casino. They did not uphold that tax. The utility tax they did uphold.
But is a use tax different than a property tax?
The way the courts have analyzed that, it depends on the nature of it. Because in the cases where a state or a local government, in my opinion, has attempted to sort of end run Mescalero by saying, well, we're not taxing the structure like they were trying to do in Mescalero. Well, we're simply taxing the privilege of owning the structure, or we're taxing the payment that gets made. Serially, there has not been a court that the state has cited to, nor that I have found, that has said that's acceptable. The only time that they have allowed these types of taxes, when they go to the Bracker analysis, which it appears we agree you really don't use when preemption under this statute is being looked at, the only time they allow that is when there is some service connected to the tax. So, and that's what the court actually in Strandberg in the 11th Circuit talked about. That's why they upheld the utility tax. But they would not uphold that simple tax on those vendors for occupying a stall in the casino. And that was really how they distinguished it. I disagree with the court in Strandberg for going to Bracker. But when they went to Bracker, which they said they had to do, that's how they came down, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'm out of time. Mr. Heap. Court will be in recess.